changes.
Turn and face the strain.
Changes. Don't tell them to blow up on Olivet.
Welcome back for the third hour of Issues, Etc. We're going to be talking with Dr. Stanton Jones. He has co-authored a very interesting new book called Ex-Gaze, a longitudinal study of religiously mediated change in sexual orientation. We have also talked on many occasions with guests. I'm thinking about, why does the name escape me now? But it does. We've talked with guests who, as part of their vocation or avocation in life, as former homosexuals, take part in what the research calls Exodus ministries, changing or mitigating homosexual tendencies or orientation. So the conventional wisdom, in fact, the official position, if I'm not mistaken, of many psychological associations is that sexual orientation cannot change, it's immutable, and to try and change it by any means, but especially by religiously mediated means, is harmful. Is this true? We're going to answer those questions here for the next half hour of Issues, Etc. Dr. Stanton Jones is provost and professor of psychology at Wheaton College, co-author of the book, Ex-Gaze, a Longitudinal Study of Religiously Mediated Change in Sexual Orientation. Dr. Jones, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you for having me, Todd. It's great to be here.
This is a massive research. What was the most surprising finding in your research about religiously mediated change in sexual orientation?
The single most surprising finding was when the secular mental health establishment has responded to the kind of claims that you're talking about, Exodus, you talked about talking with folks from Exodus, the common claim from disbelievers is, well, anybody who could change must not have been truly gay to start off with. They must have been bisexual, because anybody who's truly gay, by definition, can't change. Now, you can see this becomes a closed circle of logic, because it becomes then very difficult to ever prove that anybody can actually change. But so what we did to examine that is we set up a set of rigorous empirical markers in our studies, more rigorous than we've seen in any other study, to define a truly gay subpopulation. To be a part of this subpopulation, you had to have predominantly homosexual sexual arousal. You had to have acted repeatedly on that, and you had to have actually immersed yourself in gay identity and the gay lifestyle for a substantial portion of your life. And about half of our population met these standards. And so our most surprising finding was the secular mental health establishment would predict that the people in this group would have necessarily have experienced no change or less change. And in fact, on average, people experienced more change in this group than those who didn't fall into the group, and among some of our most successful categories of outcomes, we found representatives of this truly gay subgroup just right there alongside other people who participated in the study.
Now, you dealt with two questions: can sexual orientation be changed, and is it harmful to attempt a change in sexual orientation by any means? How does the American Psychological Association currently answer those two questions?
The American Psychological Association answers it, frankly, in a profoundly ambivalent and confusing way. In terms of official pronouncements, the official pronouncements that have come out of the Council of Representatives that governs, what you find is resolutions that are extremely tortured in their language. They're full of probabilities. We're concerned that harm might happen. Change has not been documented by scientific means, and it's doubtful that it exists, but it's extremely cautious and convoluted language. However, when that language gets translated on the website of the APA, where they talk straight to people seeking advice, you can go on the public affairs website of the American Psychological Association, and there's a section about questions and answers about sexual orientation, and it says flat out on that website, sexual orientation is not changeable. It makes an absolutely emphatic claim. And then in that same question, it goes on to say, we have profound concerns about harm that comes from attempting to change. The American Psychiatric Association has a very similar statement and is even more specific. We're concerned about depression, anxiety, and other serious emotional consequences of attempting to change. And so on that latter question, what we did in the study is we simply, every time we assessed these individuals in the study, and those occurred at about one-year intervals, we administered a standard psychological inventory of distress that is sort of a commonplace instrument to use in psychotherapy and counseling outcome research. And we simply found that over time, individuals who are continuing in the change process did not become more distressed, and on average, the people who were continuing with the process were no more distressed at the time three assessment than they were at our initial time one assessment. So it didn't seem to contribute to growing distress over time.
Those answers from the American Psychological Association, the American Psychiatric Association on change and whether or not it's harmful to try change sexual orientation, was this always the considered view of the psychotherapeutic community?
Definitively not. There's always been complexity in this, and you know, oftentimes you have different people saying different things. But going back into the 1960s and 1970s, homosexual orientation was considered a disorder, and then there was a major change in the 1970s that was in part a response to sort of growing cultural acceptance and in part a response to the growing political and socio-political power of the gay community. And so you see from the mid-70s through the mid to late 80s, a steady evolution in how the mental health field's treated, where it's not considered a disorder in its own right, and then it's written out rather completely. And now it's actually the only mention of psychological disorder is if you're bothered about your sexual orientation. So whereas once upon a time to be a homosexual person was to be disordered, now to be a Christian and to be concerned about your sexual orientation is to be suggestive of mental illness itself. So the table has turned rather dramatically. And in the exact same way, in terms of how treatment outcome was considered, there's actually dozens of studies in the 1960s, 70s, and some of them into the 1980s that suggested that change was possible for some people. It was not regarded as a very easy sort of condition to generate change. There was never really rosy, optimistic thoughts about the change process. But you begin to see with the changing diagnosis, you see the beginning of the disappearance of that research. People just were not doing the research. And interestingly, people today say that somehow it's somehow scientifically proven that change is impossible. What has really happened is simply that past research has just been dismissed cynically as being false, as being untrue, as being motivated by homophobia. And so you have people picking apart the studies for ways they could have been better, and then somehow concluding that because you can criticize the study, that the study is somehow illegitimate. So what we attempted to do in our study was simply to do a better study than ever has been done before. Our study focused on change by religious ministry, but the greater amount of research has been done on psychotherapy and apart from religious motivation. And we tried to do a study methodologically that was superior to any study that had ever been done before, and to focus on this issue of religious change. And so we feel like we did that successfully, and thus produced evidence that really must be considered on these two key questions. We believe that it is false to say that sexual orientation can never change, and we feel that it is false to say that on average people are likely to experience high levels of psychological distress by attempting to change.
In terms of the nuts and bolts of your research and your study,
yes.
How many subjects, how long a time were they monitored?
Yes. We followed 98 subjects, which is not a huge population, but as change studies go, that's not a bad population, especially when your starting hypothesis is that change is impossible, because anybody who thinks logically can recognize right away that you only need one case to disprove that change is impossible. So we followed these 98 people, and we followed them over a three-year period, and some of the distinctives of the study are, first of all, very few studies in this area actually start when people are early in the change process. So we did not pick up success cases after the fact and ask them to remember what they were like, but we started assessing them while they were in the change process. And then we followed them longitudinally, which also has rarely been done, where you actually don't just assess them one time, but you assess them again and again. So the book actually reports on the time one, time two, and time three assessments, which span about a three-year average of time. We've actually continued the research and are in the process of gathering our time six information, and we hope to, about a year from now, be in a position to report on those latter three assessments. So we're giving an initial report in this book, and we're going to keep studying this population through this year.
You mentioned before one of your hypotheses, accepting as a hypothesis in your research that change cannot occur.
Yes.
Can I be safe in assuming that your other hypothesis was that subjects would be harmed through religiously mediated change in sexual orientation?
That's actually correct. And just lest I confuse your audience, we went into the research in terms of what did we believe as Christians and as human beings and as scientists in terms of people we had talked about, had talked with, and people that we knew in depth. We did believe that change was possible, and we didn't believe that the change was often harmful. But we accepted as our hypotheses what the secular mental health community proposed, because those hypotheses serve as wonderful scientific hypotheses. The ideal scientific hypothesis is a claim that you can actually falsify by the data that you gather. And so when the secular community says emphatically change is impossible and the attempt is harmful, that makes a wonderful scientific hypothesis for you to gather data around. And as we argue in our book, our data allows us to refute those hypotheses and thus assert the opposite, that change is possible and that the attempt is not on average harmful.
Dr. Stanton Jones is our guest. He's co-author of a new book titled Ex-Gays, A Longitudinal Study of Religiously Mediated Change in Sexual Orientation. It's this new study about people who are currently going through and coming out of homosexual lifestyle and orientation. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We are coming to you live this Wednesday, October the 10th, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. No research is immune from criticism, and I noticed that the latter part of your book, you do anticipate some criticisms of the research, and of course it's good to hear that the research continues, because some of those criticisms can be answered by further research. What do you think the biggest criticism your research has come in for by those who want to insist that sexual orientation cannot change and that it's harmful to try?
If you don't mind, I'll mention three biggies off the bat. One is, even before the study was released, when rumors were just beginning to build in the internet world, the immediate thing that was said was that this is sham research by sham researchers at right-wing universities. And the basic notion that was thrown out was that because we were completely honest, that both of us as co-authors and researchers are evangelical Christians, the assumption was made that this is biased research, is what was thrown at us. And that is something that I'd like to refute absolutely. Our commitment from the beginning, for instance, we say very openly in the book that this research required some monetary resources, and we got those monetary resources from Exodus. But we also told Exodus from the beginning they wanted this research done because they were confident that change really did happen. But we told them, look, we want you to know that in accepting your money, precisely because we're Christians, we're committed to telling the truth. And if the truth of this that the research finds is embarrassing to you, to Exodus, we want you to know that as soon as you say yes to this research, you lose control of it, because we're going to do it and we're going to report whatever we find. So I would say emphatically that the research is not biased. The second major criticism that we get is there's a bunch of people out there who say, well, you can't trust the self-report of these people. What we really need are biological measures of sexual orientation. And this is an absolutely ludicrous criticism of the study for a number of reasons. First of all, there are no well-validated scientific measures of sexual orientation. Sure, you can wire up a person's genitals and see what turns them on when they watch pornography, but there are lots of holes in that research, and it's not a demonstrably valid way to assess sexual orientation. Similarly with brain scans. And actually, I forgot the third criticism that I was going to mention, so I'll just leave it at those two.
Okay, so in other words, you are openly acknowledging that There are things that you didn't, or in this case, in the case of your last mention, really couldn't practically do way of research methods.
That's right.
And you're making, it sounds as though you're saying, look, our claims here do overturn the conventional wisdom of the American Psychological and Psychiatric Associations, but these are really modest claims in the end.
That's right. In the end, we're not claiming that everybody can change, because our study quite evidently does not demonstrate that. Some people didn't change in the study. It also doesn't claim that nobody is ever harmed. There are very unwise, cruel, misguided attempts to help people, or even to hurt people that people can engage in. And so people can be hurt, and some people don't change. We are just suggesting that change is real. And let me just throw out the last criticism I did just remember, and that is that some people say, well, if these people don't experience absolutely dramatic 100% homosexual to 100% heterosexual change, then the change is not real. Even the people who experience the greatest success experienced complicated changes. None of these people, as far as I know, would ever say that we're never subject to homosexual temptation again. They just say, my homosexual attraction is dramatically less and my heterosexual attraction is dramatically more. But doesn't that sound like the change that most of us experience? When people go through marital therapy and say, I'm dramatically changed, they don't say, well, I never get angry at my spouse, we never fight. They just say, I have a different quality of life now. When people go through depression treatment or treatment for an addiction, they don't say, well, I'm never tempted anymore, or I never get down again anymore, but rather I've got the tools to be able to live a very different life than what I used to live. That's very similar to what these individuals are reporting. And so the critics say this isn't real change, but these are people who say I'm living a different kind of life. And I think that those criticisms really just don't hold much water.
I guess we probably should have covered this a little earlier, but as by way of definition of change,
yes,
in sexual orientation, you're not simply talking about someone going from truly gay was the category that you guys used.
That's right.
There, truly gay to truly heterosexual.
Right.
You're talking here in some cases about
chastity.
Chastity,
yeah,
or true, or perhaps a true change in sexual orientation.
That's
the
right.
Whole spectrum.
And for your audience, let me just say that in terms of the outcomes for our research participants, a slightly less than a third were people that Exodus would consider failures. These were people who went back to the gay lifestyle or report that they experienced absolutely no change, but they don't want to go in the gay lifestyle, and now they don't really even know what they're going to do with their lives. That's slightly less than a third. Then approximately a third of the people report that yes, my homosexual attraction went down some, but I'm definitely not satisfied with the success I've achieved, but I'm encouraged enough that I'm continuing the change process. So that's about a third. And then just more than a third, almost 40% of our subjects fell into one of two success categories. About 15% reported substantial conversion to heterosexual orientation. These are people whose homosexual attractions went substantially down and their heterosexual attractions went substantially up. Quite a number of these people either were married when they started. They were people who had been in denial of their homosexual attractions, but they report a different sort of experience of their heterosexual relationship now, or people who actually have married since the process of change began. So those are people who experience conversion. But a controversial part of the success group are people that we call success chastity. These are people who experience a substantial decrease in homosexual attraction, and they report now that I don't define my life by my sexual orientation. Rather, I am able to live as a single person who I take my identity from being a Christian, not from being a homosexual person. And they report that they have a satisfying and substantially gratifying way to live their life as a chaste single person in the way that the church has classically understood a single person ought to live.
Do you claim that your research in any way addresses the question of whether or not these changes are evidence of divine intervention?
That's a great question. And actually, as scientists, we don't. What we say is that there's no instrument we can get here that actually says whether this happens merely because religion is a way to get people really motivated, and it really, you know, garners all their psychological resources, and so they move forward. I mean, a skeptic who doesn't believe in God would look at this and say, well, I can see where, you know, religious people think that this, that God is doing it, but it's but something else is going on. Our methodology can't say no to that hypothesis, but clearly, especially since the secular community says that change is impossible, something very meaningful is going on here.
You addressed this in brief a moment ago, but I want to come back to it with the few minutes left to us. As to the permanence of the change, I guess that really time will tell. Is that the best response that we can give there? Someone says, are these changes permanent or are they temporary?
Exactly. Time will tell. And, you know, we may well have people who drop out. In fact, we report openly in the book that one of the people that we present as one of our success cases in the book, because that's how this person reported himself at time three, by the time he got to time four, had written us a letter saying, you know what, I experienced a crisis and I went back to gay identity and I'm no longer a success. And we report that openly, and we will continue to report that openly. But the reason why we don't then react with cynicism to all our other success cases is because it's equally possible that other people would experience dramatic change in a positive direction for Exodus. And so are there people who, after 10 years of saying, I'm living successfully, then they say, nope, this is a sham, I'm going back into gay identity? Of course that happens. We recognize that. But there are also people who, after living 20 years in gay lifestyle, say, this is terrible, and I've experienced dramatic change. Many of your listeners may know that a woman who was a lesbian activist and a publisher of a magazine called Venus, a lesbian advocacy magazine, after, you know, decades in the gay lifestyle, recently converted to Christ and is now, you know, going in a very different direction in her life. And I just read the testimony, the man who's really this spiritual inspiration and personal inspiration for the Exodus movement, a guy named Frank Worthen, is now 73 years old and married when he was 55, and he and his wife have successfully lived together for, you know, almost 20 years now. So clearly there are testimonies out there of substantial change that lasts over time. So some people may change. There's a tendency for people to say, if I hear that negative, cynical example of somebody leaving the lifestyle, that means it's all a sham. And that's what a rigorous scientific methodology won't allow you to do. It won't allow you to make your decisions based on one or two saucy anecdotes.
Dr. Jones, do you have a few minutes to give us on the other side of the break?
I do.
All right. We're going to keep Dr. Jones here through this break, and when we come back from that break, we'll go immediately to the phones for questions and comments from our listeners. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us here in the studio this Wednesday, October the 10th, issues@kfuo.org. We're talking with Dr. Stanton Jones, provost and professor of psychology at Wheaton College, co-author of a new book titled Ex-Gays, A Longitudinal Study of Religiously Mediated Change in Sexual Orientation. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issues@kfuo.org. If you're waiting on the phone, please be patient. We'll get to your phone calls right after this. Talking about a new study on people, well, you know, we're told by the people who should know better, by the people who are experts in psychology and psychiatry, that it just can't be that if someone changes sexual orientation, maybe they weren't what they thought they were all along, and yet people have found change, not perfect, not always permanent, but change. And the harm isn't what the psychiatrist or the psychologist, by and large, have been telling us. So this kind of research, what comes next? What are the implications? What does it mean? When we come back, we'll answer those questions. Dr. Stanton Jones is our guest. Stay tuned.
Where Christianity meets culture. You're listening to Issues, Etc. In 2 Corinthians 6, Paul writes, "Do not be unequally yoked with unbelievers." Is he talking about marriage there, or is he talking about other relationships, business relationships? We'll talk about that with Pastor David Marth of Historic Trinity Lutheran Church in Soulard next time on our 10:05 Bible study. I hope you join us. The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people. Here's a happy AM 850 KFUO salute to our day sponsor on this Wednesday, October 10th, 2007, John Thompson. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to AM 850 KFUO in celebration of his wife's birthday. His wife's name is Christine. Once again, we say thank you to John Thompson of DePere, our AM 850 KFUO day sponsor, and our very best wishes for a happy birthday to Christine.
Creation evangelism, it's slow at first.
Answers with Ken Ham, author of the children's book, What Really Happened to the Dinosaurs? Well, Ken, what do you mean by creation evangelism, and why aren't the results so immediate?
Well, simply put, Mark, people can't understand the message of the cross and the resurrection if they don't already have an understanding of sin and why Jesus died. You see, today, increasing numbers of people have been trained in an education system that's devoid of the knowledge of God. Evolutionary indoctrination has resulted in many people not having any concept of the loving Creator God of the Bible and the nature of sin. Now, creation evangelism is the name given to a powerful method to reach these people. We first need to remove the stumbling block of evolution and millions of years by showing their fallacies and then present the truth of the history of the world beginning with Genesis. Do you know that many people have committed their lives to Christ as a result of using this method? Including a friend whose testimony was read out at a family camp a few weeks ago. But you know, the results are slow at first. This is because a person has to change his or her whole way of thinking from the foundation up. If we're going to be successful in evangelism in today's secular world, we need to understand that although results will be slow at first, creation evangelism works.
One of our most effective evangelistic tools is Ken Ham's free booklet on the topic of why a loving God allows suffering and death in this world. You can get your free copy by going to our website, answersradio.com.
What do you think of a politician who supports a law that permits immorality, but then says that he is personally opposed to it? Where is the line drawn when such a position becomes hypocritical, to say the least? The distinctions that you need to know where the lines are drawn, are for the next broadcast of Law and Gospel.
Listen to Law and Gospel weekday afternoons from 1 till 3 on AM 850 KFUO.
Rally Day on AM 850 KFUO is Thursday, October 25th. We're hoping that you will call to pledge or renew your day sponsorship. Generous supporters are encouraging you to participate. It's your chance to claim the Share Time Together package, including a one-night weekend stay at a Drury brand hotel, plus a basket of wine and chocolate truffles from KKO Chocolate, along with a $25 gift certificate from Hautley Cheese, or the Bevo Mill Dinner Theater package featuring a $90 gift certificate toward the cost of two reservations for the Friday Murder Mystery Dinner Theater at the historic Bevo Mill, or the Box Society Christmas package, including a gift certificate for two tickets to the Box Society Christmas Candlelight Concert Monday, December 17th at Powell Symphony Hall, along with the CD recording of Christmas with the Box Society. It's titled Yesu Joy. Be listening Rally Day, Thursday, October 25th, for your chance to sign up to be an AM 850 KFUO day sponsor. And thanks for your generous and consistent support of the radio ministry of AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back. Last half hour of Issues, Etc. Dr. Stanton Jones is our guest. When I heard about this book, I heard an interview that he did, I think it was a national radio interview that he did on the book, Ex Gaze. I told my producer immediately, we need to talk about this research. It's very important, not only to dispel the myths on the one side, the kind of myths that are put forth by the American Psychological Association, but also to keep in check the myths that operate on the other side, that everyone can change and that all changes are permanent, the rosy picture that the research does not necessarily support, so that we have an accurate picture, and as complex as it is, about change in sexual orientation when it comes to religiously mediated programs. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Phil has been patiently waiting on the line. Phil, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi.
Hi.
I had an experience. It's when I first became a Christian, I had a delivery job, and a couple times a week I would to get my truck unloaded by this man, and I had no idea he was gay. And it was for about 3 years, and I was a new Christian, so I was excited about what I just heard on the radio, what I was learning. So I would always share it with him, and he would just pat me on the back and tolerate what I was saying. And after the 3 years, I got a new job. I told him, hey, I'll come back and check on you. And I came back probably about a year later, and I always carried a little pocket Bible, and I would share things with him through that. Well, when I seen him about the year later, he told me that that he used to be a homosexual, and because I was talking to him, that he started going to church. He said, I thought there was something to it. So, and I, like I said, I had no idea, so it wasn't like I was trying to do anything and witness to him. It was just all God doing that.
Phil, thank you very much. Dr. Jones, the research doesn't necessarily deal or doesn't deal with, what would we call this, informal means by which someone's sexual orientation may change.
Yes. Actually, there's some interesting developments in that way. Let me just throw out two. First of all, while there's a lot of emphasis on formal psychotherapy and counseling in the research and in the profession, because let's face it, that's where a lot of practitioners make their living and so forth, and there's a lot of good that can happen there. But there's a whole body of research in a subdiscipline that many people don't hear about called community psychology that emphasizes that a lot of the most tremendous support that people get occurs in directions that have to do with support in churches, in friendships, in families, that some of the most effective, quote-unquote, psychotherapy and counseling occurs in precisely the kind of relationships that the caller just talked about, and in, you know, in the hairdresser, the barber that you talk to, the pastor who cares for you, the Bible study in your community. So there's a lot that happens that way, and so that's really a great thing to bring out.
Two final questions. You mentioned that the research has continued after the publication of your initial findings in the
yes.
book, and I'm curious, without giving too much away, does the continued tracking over the longitudinal tracking of these subjects, does it continue to bear out the initial findings that are reported in your book?
You know, we actually have not analyzed the data in any formal way. I will say that based on our informal survey, what we're looking at, we're encouraged that the pattern is going to continue. Can I just put in one quick thing about the book, by the way, that I hope will be of interest to your listeners? If you listen just to the subtitle, A Longitudinal Study of Religiously Mediated Blah, 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 you might think that, oh, man, there's no way that that anybody other than a researcher would read this book. But we've been we set out intentionally to make this book readable by intelligent Christian people. And one of the most encouraging things I said that I heard at the conference where we announced the studies is someone walked up to me and said, you know, I've only had one course in psychology. This is somebody who worked for the publisher. He said, I only had one course in psychology, and I thought I'll never, you know, read this book. He said, I picked it up and I actually read it cover to cover, and it's the book not only has scientific, you know, tables of statistics and so forth, but it is filled with the testimonies of what people are saying is happening in their life, and we explain the research methodology in ways that any intelligent reader should be able to. So if you're interested in this research, in this topic, we think that you'll find this to be a book that is readable.
You mentioned before that this is not really so much new research or groundbreaking research, except in the methodology, but you guys are actually just picking up where research was headed before the 1960s and before a change of ideas in the psychotherapeutic community. What are the implications now of this research that you have rejoined?
The implications now, I would say the major implication is that right now the American Psychological Association has a 5-person blue ribbon panel that is working out the next phase, the next evolution of the professional guidelines for that will govern psychotherapy and counseling. And by the people that were picked to serve on that blue ribbon panel, we're gravely concerned that no one who thinks that change is possible is represented in this committee. And so we're fearful that the American Psychological Association will lead the way in a complete ban of professional support for people trying to change, and a complete ban of that will be used against religious ministries to suppress the right of people to seek help when they want want help with their sexual orientation. So the immediate implication of the research is that we hope that there will be more modesty, more hesitancy, more scientific skepticism on the part of what happens in our professions. And I actually neglected to mention in the previous question, I did want to throw out that there's interesting supporting things that are popping up in a variety of other places. For instance, in the latest issue of Mother Jones magazine, there's, an article that raises questions about the research about the biological origins and profiles a number of people who, apart from a religious orientation, have sought help to change sexual orientation and feel that they've changed dramatically. And in the there's a researcher named Lisa Diamond who's published in one of the premier psychology journals, Perspectives on Psychological Science, who's been following 85 lesbians over time. Over a long period of time, and she actually reports that these people, apart from religious faith, that some of them experience very dramatic changes in their sexual orientation and sexual experience. Women who firmly identified 10 years ago as lesbian and are now married and have children and identify themselves as heterosexual. So there are these cracks in the dike that are appearing, and we hope that the American Psychological Association will pay careful attention to those realities.
Dr. Stanton Jones is provost and professor of psychology at Wheaton College. He's co-authored the new book, Ex-Gays, A Longitudinal Study of Religiously Mediated Change in Sexual Orientation. Dr. Jones, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Thank you very much, and keep up the good work in your research and your colleagues as well.
Thank you for a great interview, Todd. Enjoyed it.
Well, for the last, we got about 20 minutes here left in the program. For the last 20 minutes, we're going to turn to one of those top-of-the-mind stories that probably is swirling in the internet and the news cycle for the next day or two. They used to call them presidential debates. I read recently about the debates between, it wasn't presidential, this in the case of someone trying to be run for Congress, Lincoln and Douglas. Do you remember those old debates? None of us were alive for it, of course, but these were debates. You had Lincoln taking a position, a rather moderate position, on the issue of slavery and the issue of the sectional differences between North and South. And you had Douglas taking a moderate position in favor of these things, and they managed to meet together regularly, together face-to-face, on the same platform in very long fora that they called debates, and they actually gave their positions. They debated. They dealt with one another's issues. They answered one another, and it really was, even in an age before television, considered to be a monumental event in American history. Well, now we have the presidential debates where you just can't fit everybody on the same stage. And we haven't even gotten down to the point where it's one candidate for one party and another candidate for another. Last night, I think it was the sixth presidential debate, the GOP met together. What made this one unique, of course, is there was a new face on the dais. Of course, Fred Thompson recently announced that he's running for president, too, and joined the other GOP candidates in the debate last night. Here's the story from Associated Press.
The sixth Republican presidential debate started right with the newcomer, Senator Fred Thompson, and his thoughts on the economy.
I see no reason to believe we're headed for an economic downturn.
After that bit of a stumble, Thompson warmed up on stage and spoke comfortably from then on. The other candidates have been ribbing him for not announcing until last month in Iowa. The candidate who got most of the attention wasn't even on stage.
I can't wait to debate with her because I've done it. She's just talking.
Hillary, the other day, remember the Hillary Bond program? She's going to give $5,000 to every child born in America with her picture on it?
For the most part, this debate was peaceful for the Republicans, with the economy as the main topic.
The bulk of the taxes are paid by wealthy people. Should we reform our tax code, which is completely broken?
If you want to control federal spending, you must look at Social Security.
Senator Thompson launched his campaign in Iowa well after his competitors. The other Republican candidates have been reaching out for this GOP nomination for months and made sure to let him know about it at the end of the night.
And Fred Thompson shows up at the end.
I've enjoyed watching these fellas. I got to admit, it was getting a little boring without me, but I'm glad to be here now.
Before this debate even began, Democrats Barack Obama, John Edwards, and Bill Richardson decided to pull their names off of the Michigan primary ballot. Joe Biden never signed up. They are protesting Michigan's decision to move its primary up to January 15th against the wishes of the National Democratic Party. Mark Carlson, The Associated Press, Dearborn, Michigan.
Well, first of all, I find it almost inconceivable that Michigan can get a primary moved up to January of the year in which we elect a president. That's amazing. You do know why national parties object to this kind of stuff. Because after the primary season begins, it gets expensive. It's already expensive. They were speculating before anyone threw their hat into the ring that this 2008 presidential election would top $1 billion between the two parties and the two candidates. $1 billion to elect a president. That's a lot of money. That is a lot of money. So, laying aside Michigan's early primary, that's fine. Fred Thompson's considered a latecomer, and we still have more than a year before the election. He's considered a latecomer and was actually criticized for jumping in so late. Of course, all of this started almost 2 years before Election Day. What did you make of the debate last night? Did you watch it? Does this make any difference to you whatsoever? Is it just a lot of window dressing? Do you think it has any real political force? Do you think it really makes a difference, moves the debate along, or moves the candidates along closer towards someone emerging as a front runner so that when we finally get to our first primary, perhaps even January, we'll be able to say, okay, this person has been vetted, they've been run up and down the flagpole, and now we have, at least for the party, Democratic or Republican, we have the best person for the job. We're putting forth our best foot. Isn't that what we all want, right? We really want a genuine debate of ideas between the two major parties in our country, and it's pretty much split 50-50, you know. The best person for the job on either side. Now, I know that kind of raw politics would suggest that we want the best person for our party, whatever that party may be, and we want the other person to put forth the most incompetent person. Think about that please. Think about the rest of the country for a moment. Because someone is going to win. It may not be your party, whatever that may be. You still do want the best president, don't you? I mean, we cannot be so filled with political spite that we would desire an incompetent, terrible president for 4 years just to teach the country a lesson? Interesting. Although, speaking of that, that's exactly the kind of criticism that some prominent evangelical Christians are coming in for by their otherwise allies in the mainstream press. And yes, evangelical Christians do have allies in the mainstream press. Because there are some evangelical Christians, James Dobson in particular, who is not happy with anybody. Not really happy with anybody, at least he's not saying who he's happy with in the GOP ticket. And he and other religious leaders have decided that if they can't get the kind of candidate they want, they're not going to be voting for a compromise candidate. He was recently interviewed extensively by Sean Hannity on Sean Hannity's program, Hannity and Combs. And just part of the interview dealt with Dr. Dobson of Focus on the Family's concerns about the GOP's prospects and his plans on how he as an individual, not as a leader of Focus on the Family, plans to vote if push comes to shove. Here's the interview.
Now, you have heard the reports about some conservatives being upset with the positions of the Republican frontrunners for president. Well, tonight, in a Hannity and Combs exclusive interview, Dr. James Dobson addresses those concerns and what he plans to do about it. Well, you knew when you wrote this op-ed in the New York Times that it would create a lot of controversy. It's got a lot of people talking. Let me just surmise this for everybody. You and about 50 pro-family leaders met in Salt Lake City. And after 2 hours of deliberation, you came up with a resolution that you surmised in the New York Times op-ed as the following. If neither of the two major political parties nominates an individual who pledges himself or herself to the sanctity of human life, we will join others in voting for a minor party candidate. Those agreeing with the proposition were invited to stand, and the result was almost unanimous.
Sean, I really do need, because this is political in nature, to explain that I'm not speaking for Focus on the Family. I'm speaking directly for myself, and so I hope people understand that today. You know what, Sean? This is a very, very difficult issue. It's one of the toughest I've ever had to face. And I know you and I see it differently, even though we agree on 99% of the issues. But I think it's going to be a division throughout the conservative movement, because it is not an easy thing to either explain or a position to take. And what we did there in Salt Lake was not easy for us either.
All right, we're listening to Sean Hannity and Dr. James Dobson of Focus on the Family. And I do want to point out that Dr. Dobson is speaking as a private citizen and not as a representative of his organization here in this interview, as he pointed out. They're talking about the unwillingness of Dobson and others to compromise, especially on the life issue, to compromise in order to get, well, let's just say it, to get a Republican in office rather than a Democrat. They're not willing to compromise. They're not happy with what they see, and they're not willing to vote for someone just to keep, well, I guess let's just say it, just to keep Hillary Clinton or someone else out of the White House. Now, the argument, of course, is being made that if they do that and they don't throw their support in the right direction, even a compromise candidate most likely will have a pro-choice candidate in the White House after 2008. Let's see what Steve has to say. He's calling from his car. Hi, Steve.
I don't know if this is applicable to Dobson, but I find it interesting where you get Christians where they're unwilling to compromise on politics, but they're willing to compromise on theology. And so
you're reading my mind.
Yes. And so they're like, well, I can't compromise on X issue, but on X theological position, well, you know, that's subject to debate.
Well, Steve, thank you very much. I'm glad you brought that up. Isn't it weird? Isn't it strange? There are Christians who would never compromise, and let's give them their due, shouldn't compromise on issues like abortion or the life issue or gay marriage. They would not compromise on that, and rightly so. Rightly so. But when it comes to matters that they consider quote-unquote theological, matters of doctrine, they make this false separation between doctrine and morals for some reason. It's all theology, isn't it? Morality is nothing other than God's expression to us of his own character. But when it comes to other issues, they suddenly become, well, liberal. Willing to compromise on, we see through a mirror darkly. Don't you understand? None of us really has the whole truth. We're like blind men fumbling around at the feet of an elephant. And all these analogies come out when it comes to matters of theology, doctrine. And yet they see the need to have a no-compromise position when it comes to other issues to which Scripture speaks. So why is abortion, why is gay marriage something upon which so many Christians are unwilling to compromise, and rightly so, and not other clear teachings of Scripture? I mean, I could just name a few. There are Christians who are willing to compromise on something as fundamental as the Trinity. Come on, who really knows who God is? They're willing to compromise on other matters that are spoken of in the creeds, for heaven's sake. Willing to compromise on the clear teaching of Scripture on the Lord's Supper? The role of women in the church? Why? Why can they see the need for a no-compromise position on one issue that Scripture speaks to and not on others? I wrote an article about this, by the way, a couple years back, called Bible-Believing Liberals. If you want a copy of it, I'll send it to you absolutely free. Just email me, twilken@kfuo.org, twilken@kfuo.org, and I'll send you a copy of that called Bible-Believing Liberals. Steve, thank you very much for the call. Let's see how much we can get in here of this interview between Sean Hannity and James Dobson on the GOP prospects before our time runs out.
Well, let me tell you, if in fact this is the case, we have some poll numbers, and we'll put it up on the screen for our audience here. Mm. And this was a Rasmussen poll. And the bottom line in the case, for example, of Rudy Giuliani, that if in fact that you were to mount a third-party challenge and support a third-party candidate, the result, quote, would be a landslide victory for Hillary Clinton. Now, that's the same partial birth abortion supporting Hillary. That's national health care Hillary. That's Ruth Bader Ginsburg Hillary or worse.
Are you prepared to accept that inevitable result?
Well, that's what I mean when I say it's difficult. It's bad on both sides. We're very, very concerned about the implications of a Hillary Clinton presidency. But we have been working, Sean, for 35 years I've been trying to defend the unborn child. And 19 years ago, in 1988, I came to Washington and there were 400,000 people at the Washington Monument. And I stood up there on that day, we still have it on videotape, where I said, I pledge hereby never for the rest of my life to vote for anyone who would kill innocent babies. That's been my life. That's been my belief. Along with marriage and the family and other things. I can't now abandon that because we've got two bad choices here.
Two bad choices. That's a good summary of Dobson's position there. So what do you think about it? That's not all there is, but it may be all we have time for. He just says, look, it may mean a Hillary candidacy, and he's not comfortable with that. It may mean Hillary in the White House, Hillary Clinton there in the White House, which would be, golly, kind of cutting off your nose to spite your face. But he did make that pledge, and you got to commend him for that. Should Christians compromise in terms of who they're going to vote for on issues like life and gay marriage to get the lesser of two evils? Kathy's calling from St. Charles. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to say some of a lot of what's going on now in politics, I think, is just posturing, and it has no significance. But I do think that it is. I want to kind of just say ditto to what the last caller said, and also, there are some things in the Bible that says, "Thus saith the Lord," on certain issues, of course, like murdering. But a lot of Christians will get all bent out of shape about things that don't. There is no "thus saith the Lord," you know, trick-or-treating costumes, or, you know, all kinds of things. I have a friend who recently, you know, doesn't think that it's all right to be a hillbilly because she thinks that would offend country folk and things like that. Hmm. And so it's not a moral issue, but maybe this same person might think it's okay to have evangelical Bible studies in a Lutheran church and you know, not protect her kids against false teaching. So I have concerns about that in the Christian faith.
Kathy, thank you very much. See, Kathy's made the point quite well. This is simply a matter of Christians not picking and choosing what parts of God's word they're willing to stand by. Do you have to choose your battles when it comes to politics? Yes, because politics is the art of the possible. Let's remember that. But when it comes to what God's word clearly says, and Kathy was right to say, "Thus saith the Lord," where the Bible teaches clearly, and it's much clearer than many Christians think, where the Bible teaches clearly, Christians must take their stand. Where the Bible speaks, we speak. It's not optional. We speak and we stand. Where the Bible is silent, we remain silent. Oh, by the way, I mentioned Bible-believing liberals in our next Issues, Etc. journal. I got an article called Five Laws of Christian Freedom. I just mentioned one of them. Where the Bible speaks, speak. Where the Bible is silent, be silent. It's the next Issues, Etc. journal coming out pretty soon here. If you want one, you can give us a call, a resource line, 1-800-737-0172. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about the rise of Mitt Romney, perhaps a Mormon president. Lisa Miller of Newsweek magazine will be our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.